What you told Carrie. When I left this building, I crossed 8th Street. Inside the mobile store, I bought a prepaid phone, the kind a European tourist might buy on a visit to New York City. In some circles, it would be called a burner. I was going to need it. I had made my decision weeks ago. I would never be Jason's wife again. Which meant I needed a longer-term plan. 55. 3 days later. I remember when I used to think of the reserved cars at the front of the Cannonball as the equivalent of a private jet, the way the rich folks arrived to the Hamptons in the summer. A couple of times a week, an express train ran between Manhattan and the Hamptons, shaving the ride down to about 2 hours. The big splurge was a booked seat during peak season at double the price with bar service and no anxiety about having to find room on a train carrying twice the number of people intended. Now, our $51 tickets felt like slumming. The Audi had been sold, along with the carriage house, so driving was no longer an option. Last summer, we had gotten into the habit of using the helicopter service to save time, because in Jason's world, time was money. Now, we were the kind of people who rode the train, springing for the reserved seats. You sure your mom's okay with me staying there? Susanna offered me a guest room. I was too busy waving down a taxi in the crowd to have this discussion with him again. We've talked about this 100 times. If I could get away with staying with Susanna instead of Mom's, I would totally do that, but Mom would kill me. And Spencer wants you at home with us. The plan was for Jason and me to take the twin beds in my childhood room because Spencer asked to sleep in the living room, where I knew he'd stay up all night watching YouTube. This was going to be our first weekend as a family under one roof in more than a month. Angela? The cab driver was looking at me in the rearview mirror. Hey, yeah, sorry, I can't see you from back here. I leaned over the bench seat to get a better view of the driver. The man was probably about my age, but didn't look great. Something about him seemed familiar.
It's Steve.
Steve, right, Steve. Yes, of course, it's so great to see you. I searched the recesses of my memory for the local Steves. Clerk at IGA, bartender at Wolfie's, Trisha's cousin?
Yep, Trisha's cousin. That was the one.
How are your parents? Steve's father was the least horrible brother among the Faulkner men. He was a mechanic at the shop on Spring's fireplace. His mother used to sew tablecloths and napkins to sell at the farmer's market.
Dad passed last year, a stroke. Same with yours, right?
5 years ago. I'm so sorry.
Mom, she's okay. Needs a walker already because of swelling in her legs, but otherwise she's doing good.
Jason was looking at me, obviously wishing we had taken Mom up on her offer to meet us at the train station. Well, it's real nice seeing you. We're only out for the weekend. For some reason, I needed him to know we didn't own a house here. My son's been out staying with his grandmom. We're here to pick him up.
Don't suppose you heard from Trisha this summer?
I shook my head. I haven't talked to her since, wow, high school, I guess.
I figured. I thought maybe with you being in the news and everything, she might have reached out.
He was looking at Jason, not me, in the rearview mirror. Nope, I said. She may not even know I got married. How's she doing?
No one knows. She always said she was going to get away from here and never speak to another member of the family. I guess she meant it.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Ah, the two of you were always the same, wanting to get as far away as possible. Hell, if she had stuck around, you probably wouldn't give her a second thought, the way you've moved on.
Next to me, Jason nudged my leg with his knee. Instead of ending the conversation, though, I leaned forward to make sure Steve could hear me. That's not true.
Yeah, well, I guess there's no way to know.
Jason rolled his eyes and began reciting a turn-by-turn guide to Mom's place to fill the silence. The house was empty, a note left on the laminate top breakfast table.
Went to IGA. Back soon. I'll cook. I thought you told her we wanted to take her to the grill tonight.
I had. She responded by saying she'd rather eat cornflakes than put up with the crowds of summer sewage.
I figured she was less likely to give me the riot act in public, Jason said.
This would be the first time my mother had seen Jason since I found out about his affair. She promised to be on good behavior. In reality, her only assurance was that she wouldn't run Jason down in front of Spencer. You still think about her? I asked.
Your mom?
No, about her. Carrie, I thought. I asked you once in our room if you loved her. You never answered me. The kitchen was so quiet, I didn't want to breathe. The only sound was a lawnmower in the distance. Yes, but not the way I love you. And she obviously didn't love me back, or she never could have done what she did. The next morning, I woke up thinking I had heard a phone ring. I opened my eyes to see Jason in the twin bed 3 feet from mine, ear already to phone. I heard muffled voices and dishes clanking in the kitchen and fumbled to find my own phone in the blankets wrapped around my legs. It was nearly 9. Jason never slept in this late. I suspected he had been waiting for me to get up before venturing anywhere near my mother. I listened to a series of uh-huhs, where, and do they know anything else, before he hung up. He was staring up at the ceiling, absolutely still. Is everything okay?
That, was Olivia. A cop, she knows, called her. They found Carrie.
Where was... I didn't finish the question. He was covering his face with his hands.
She's dead. Carrie's dead.
I joined my mother and son in the kitchen, leaving Jason alone to cry for a woman he had once loved. After breakfast, I asked if anyone wanted to take a walk up to Girard Point with me, knowing that Jason would want to go for a run and that Spencer shared my mother's view that walking was for people who didn't have cars. I waited until I had made the turn from Springs Fireplace Road onto Girard Drive to remove my burner phone and a single post-it note from my skirt pocket. Sitting on my favorite boulder, a few feet from the water, I called an international number and then used the keypad to follow the automated instructions. As a final step, I entered my 8-digit PIN, already committed to memory. The computerized system on the other end of the line confirmed that I had a balance of $100. It was official. I had an offshore account. We'd be closing on the carriage house on Tuesday. Our lawyer was planning to take care of the checks for alimony and my half of Jason's retirement account at the same time. I looked out over Gardiner's Bay, realizing that this might be the last time I saw it. I was actually going to miss this place. 56. Corinne leaned close to her bathroom mirror to apply a second coat of mascara, and then stepped back to make sure it wasn't too much. As a final check, she used her compact to inspect the back of her hair, which she sometimes forgot to tend to. Not too shabby. She had a 7th date tonight with a sports producer named Andrew, who made specials for ESPN. He was the first man she'd been willing to see that many times since the divorce. Even more surprisingly, he had asked her to go with him next weekend to a wedding in South Carolina, and she hadn't hesitated. It dawned on her that she, who prided herself on being at least one step ahead of everyone, may have gone and gotten a boyfriend without realizing it. She was strapping on high-heeled sandals she knew she'd regret later when her cell phone rang. It was a 516 area code, Nassau County. Something in the back of her brain told her what was about to happen. It was Nutter. The body had been found late the night before by 2 teenagers who had wandered away from a beach party for privacy. I'm sorry it took me so long to tell you. I've been working nonstop. No autopsy yet, obviously, but it was clearly a head injury. You were right about the missing crystal egg. She had known she was right the second she inspected Carrie's living room.
What beach?
Ocean Beach. The task force is on it now, but I'm still lead. Ocean Beach was at least an hour east of Carrie's house in Suffolk County, a 2-hour drive from Manhattan with zero traffic.
Anything new on Tom Fisher?
His wife and kids were visiting the grandparents on the Cape the night Carrie was last seen, so if he has an alibi, we don't know about it. The drive from Carrie's to the drop site and back to his place is about 90 miles. We're hoping he had to stop for gas and are checking all the stations off the Meadowbrook. And we're getting warrants now for his house, car, and office.
Married ex-boyfriend she was shaking down for money spotted at the house the last night he was seen. Corinne could imagine a judge signing off on that. If you need anything from the NYPD, let me know.
Will do.
And, hey, thanks for calling. Seriously. Corinne made it all the way to dessert before she mentioned the case to Andrew. She could tell from the way he kept looking at his napkin that he would have preferred to discuss anything else. And she knew that he would find a reason that maybe she shouldn't join him in South Carolina after all.
57. 6 days later, the nightmare began again. I was on my way home from Dr. Boyle's office when my cell phone rang. It was Susanna.
Are you okay? She sounded rushed.
Yeah, I'm fine. What's up?
You don't know? What are you talking about?
I need you to sit down.
I'm on the street, covered in sweat.
Last weekend at Mom's, there'd been a break from the city heat. I was counting down the days before I could sit on a beach again.
Just tell me.
I got a call from our crime beat guy.
Jason's in custody. They arrested him at his apartment.
I turned to face Jason's building on 8th and Mercer and remembered the three police cars I had seen pulled up to the curb on 8th Street on my way to therapy. I thought nothing of it at the time.
Is it another woman?
No, it's Carrie.
They're charging him with murder, Angela.
I reached out for something to help me stand. I was leaning against a trash can.
That doesn't make sense. She was found all the way on Ocean Beach. That's at least 2 hours away, and we gave them a timeline for the whole night.
Are you listening to yourself, Angela?
Have you forgotten that Jason wasn't actually with you?
If they arrested him, they must have evidence.
And they know you lied to the police about his alibi.
I told you to come clean by now.
Her words were still ringing in my ears when I walked into my lobby. It took a moment to register that the doorman was speaking to me.
A police officer wanted to see me.
He gestured to a man in a uniform sitting on a bench by the elevator.
Technically, he was a sheriff's deputy, not a cop, and he was there to serve me with documents. It was happening. I was subpoenaed to appear in front of a grand jury in Nassau County.
58. Netter finally answered his phone the third time Corinne tried to reach him. He obviously knew why she was calling.
Sorry, I wanted to give you a heads up, but the ADA's on the warpath about leaks.
I could have at least helped you pick them. She had learned about Jason Powell's arrest from a news report on her car radio only 20 minutes earlier. Netter had apparently gone through the Manhattan South Homicide Squad instead of contacting Corinne for assistance.
I think our DA is pissed at your DA made a statement clearing Powell before all the facts were in.
And what are the facts? Last I heard, you like Fisher for it.
He won't be happy about this either, but we matched a piece of physical evidence near the body to the DNA swab you took from Powell. Sorry.
Her swab, his case.
What kind of physical evidence? She asked.
There was a long pause, followed by another apology.
Wow, it's like that.
Okay. I guess the wife lied to me about his alibi after all.
So it would appear. The ADA subpoenaed her. We'll see if that puts the fear of God into her.
Assuming she lied, how'd he get to Long Island that night?
We're thinking he trained it out to her place and then used Carrie's car to move her body to Suffolk County and back. Hey, I gotta run.
She heard voices in the background. Wait, did you find blood in her trunk or video from the train station?
Don't worry about it. We've got DNA. It's locked and loaded.
That was the problem with DNA. It made law enforcement lazy. If they convicted the wrong person years ago, they expected DNA to fix it. And if they had DNA to match, forget about it. They were done. As she continued to crawl through traffic, she realized that transportation was the one equalizer in New York City. Unless you were in a helicopter or a hovercraft, you had to deal with this bullshit in one form or another. So how the hell had Jason Powell gotten to Long Island that night? Netter didn't seem bothered by this hole in the case, but Corinne could picture a lawyer like Olivia Randall driving a long-haul truck through it. Sitting behind the wheel of her own car, she started thinking of all the ways a person could get to Port Washington and back. The train, cab, the usual car rental companies, Zipcar, Uber, Lyft, you know. The more she thought through the options, the more futile the search felt. Forget the train. He would definitely use a car, and he would use his own car if at all possible to avoid a paper trail. His plates hadn't turned up on the readers from the bridges and tunnels, but a lot of city drivers bought blocking devices to protect themselves against red light cameras. Carrie Lynch was no longer her case, but Corinne wasn't the type to accept loose ends. Maybe she'd poke around in her spare time.
59. 5 days later. Jason looked 10 years older and 10 pounds lighter. It was the first time Olivia had been able to get me access to him since he was denied bail after his arrest. I spotted what I thought was a bruise on his left cheekbone, but he swore I was seeing things because I was worried.
How are you and Spencer holding up?
I shrugged. I mean, fine under the circumstances. I'm doing my best to tell Spencer this will all get worked out, but I see him on his computer all the time, trying to figure out why exactly his father is here.
He thinks I'm guilty.
No, of course not. I was unable to meet his eyes. If it weren't for me talking Spencer off the ledge, he'd be on the news telling anyone who would listen that Jason killed Carrie Lynch, was a horrible father, and had been on the grassy knoll with Lee Harvey Oswald. Dr. Boyle said I should expect his loyalties to swing wildly for the foreseeable future. There is one thing, I said as if it had just come to me. A New York Magazine reporter called me last night. I looked at her stuff. She's not just some blogger. She writes these long, intense pieces. She left a message for Mom, too. And right when I was coming in, Mom texted me. 3 different people out east got calls, including my old boss at Blue Heron.
What did you say?
No comment, of course, but I don't know how long I can keep that up. She's obviously digging around. When she called Mom, she even mentioned that time Trisha and I got in that car accident with the BMW guy.
And how do you feel about that?
I liked that question when it came from Dr. Boyle, but from Jason it was annoying. Afraid? Terrified? It's only a matter of time before it gets out. Jason's expression was blank. Oh, my God, I'm so sorry, I said. I'm rambling about myself when... I'll be fine, and I'll figure something out. I did my best to sound optimistic as Jason outlined Olivia's strategy to blame Tom Fisher for Carrie's murder. Already, she had confirmed that Oasis's marketing department, under Carrie's control, had spent millions more in Africa leading up to the finalization of their deal there than in other international markets. In combination with Carrie's pay records, Olivia planned to argue that Carrie was complicit in a kickback scheme at Oasis, had framed Jason to silence his concerns about the financial irregularities, and finally had been murdered when she tried to blackmail Fisher for more money. But with each tactical point he raised, I reminded myself that Olivia's job was to get her client off. Even if he was guilty, the police hadn't arrested Tom Fisher. They had arrested Jason, which meant they had evidence, and I had been racking my brain for 5 days wondering what it could be.
Olivia says the trial will take until at least November, Jason said. Spencer will be in school by then. It'll be a media frenzy. You guys should go.
Where? My mom's? No, thank you. And we can't keep sending Spencer to camp.
No, like, actually go. You have enough money, find some place where you can get some peace and quiet.
We need to stay here with you.
Why? In case you haven't noticed, I'm in jail.
He looked down at his orange jumpsuit.
I don't want you afraid of picking up your phone because some reporter is asking questions about you. And it's only going to get worse as the trial date gets closer. Seriously, I insist on this. I'm going to call Colin and literally make him find you guys somewhere to stay until the trial.
I was shaking my head.
Just promise me you'll think about it.
Fine, I'll think about it, and then not do it. I need to go now. It was an abrupt end to the visit, but we both knew I had somewhere else to be. I was testifying in front of a grand jury. 60. I did a quick scan of the room. 18 grand jurors from my quick head count, seated in 2 rows. No judge, as Olivia Randall had warned me to expect. The only other person in the room besides the court reporter was the prosecutor, a woman named Heather Rocco. The background information moved quickly, the dates of the marriage, separation, divorce, and Carrie Lynch's rape allegation. From an outsider's perspective, my entire life had boiled down to those 4 dates. Once introductions were done, ADA Rocco asked me if I understood the conditions under which I was testifying. She explained what Olivia Randall had already told me. Any witness, like me, subpoenaed to appear before a grand jury was automatically granted immunity in exchange for his or her testimony. That explanation sufficed for the ADA's purposes, but I knew far more than the grand jurors about what that meant. Unlike most states, in New York, the state's decision to force me to be here entitled me to something called transactional immunity. Olivia had called it the golden ticket of deals with the government. In short, the police could find a videotape of me helping Jason move Carrie's body to Ocean Beach, and they still wouldn't be able to prosecute me. I had blanket immunity from anything involving Carrie Lynch, full stop. On the other hand, I could not claim the 5th. Because I had immunity, nothing could actually incriminate me. The only basis I had to refuse a question was spousal privilege. Olivia had wanted me to hire a lawyer to stand in the hallway in case I needed to ask someone what I could or could not do, but I wasn't about to start cutting checks to get another attorney. After ADA Rocco had assured the grand jurors that I understood the ground rules, she dove immediately into the subject of Jason's relationship with Carrie. Isn't it true that Jason claimed he'd had a consensual affair and that Ms. Lynch fabricated the criminal allegation as an act of revenge? I apologize if I'm mistaken, but I was told that anything Jason actually said to me while we were married was privileged.
Very well, then.
Rocco paused to remind the grand jurors that they'd already heard testimony from a previous witness regarding Jason's defense. My guess was that either Detective Duncan or Brian King or both had already testified regarding the facts of the original case against Jason. In addition to the criminal case, Ms. Lynch was also pursuing a civil suit, demanding $5 million in damages. Is that correct?
Yes, that's my understanding.
And both the criminal and civil cases were dismissed after Carrie Lynch went missing?
That is what I was told after the fact.
What were the grounds for your divorce, Ms. Powell?
I believe the exact terminology is that our marriage had broken down irretrievably.
Was your husband unfaithful?
Yes.
Allegedly with Carrie Lynch?
Yes, among others. I saw two different grand jurors, both women, shift in their seats. I sensed that they didn't like the idea of my being here, forced to discuss my husband's infidelities.
But you were still married to Mr. Powell when Detective Corinne Duncan came to your home on June 7th and informed you that Carrie Lynch was missing.
Yes.
Did she ask you where your husband, Jason, was the previous night?
Yes.
Olivia had instructed me only to answer the question presented. If Rocco asked me if I knew the time, the correct answer was yes. It wasn't my responsibility to make her job easier.
And what did you tell her?
That Jason was at home with me.
It was a truthful response to the question she had posed.
What specifically did you tell her about your activities that night?
Well, there was dinner and a phone call from our son and watching La La Land before going to sleep.
And was that true?
I paused, focusing on her precise wording.
Yes.
I'm going to remind you, Ms. Powell, that you're under oath, under penalty of perjury.
I understand that.
I can ask your son under oath about that phone call, if you prefer.
I answered the question you asked, Ms. Rocco. A heavy-set woman toward the end of the second row, one of the women who had seemed uncomfortable at the mention of Jason's affairs, held up her hand sheepishly.
It's the way you worded it, she said. You asked about her activities, then asked if that was true.
The prosecutor looked confused and then embarrassed.
I didn't realize we were playing semantics, Ms. Powell.
I'm answering your questions.
Was your ex-husband, Jason Powell, with you the entire night during those activities?
No.
I said it in such an offhand manner that Rocco marched forward with the first few words of her next question before registering my response. The entire room fell silent until one of the jurors coughed. Rocco stared at me as if expecting me to retract my answer. I returned her gaze, but said nothing.
So, you weren't telling the truth to Detective Duncan when you said Mr. Powell was with you at home?
No, I was not. I had made Colin call two other defense attorneys to make certain that I had immunity. The law was absolutely clear. Because I was subpoenaed as a grand jury witness, I could not be charged, not even for my dishonesty to Detective Duncan about Jason's alibi. I could, however, be prosecuted if I lied to the grand jury, so I was determined to be truthful.
Do you know where Mr. Powell was that night?
Technically, the correct answer was no, but I still wanted to protect Jason. He was with Colin Harris.
Once again, I had caught Rocco off guard.
If you knew where your husband was that night, why did you lie to Detective Duncan and say that he was with you?
I did my best to make eye contact with each juror as I told them about the stress we'd been under since Jason's mistress had framed him for a sexual assault as punishment for not leaving his family to be with her and to curry favor with her corrupt employer. Rocco tried to cut me off, but I reminded her that I was only answering her question. The same grand juror who had pointed out Rocco's earlier imprecision said she wanted to hear my explanation. We'd spent weeks feeling like everything we did got twisted around to where no one believed anything we said. On that particular day, Jason and I had gotten into a fight because I finally realized the extent of his infidelities. He wasn't a criminal, but I wasn't exactly happy with him either. I didn't want to explain all of that to Detective Duncan. This is hard for me today, in fact, but I don't have a choice. So I said he was home with me instead.
But you don't know for certain that he was with Colin Harris all night, do you?
I know that Colin told me he was, and Colin Harris is the most honest person I know.
And I'm sure the police have her phone records.
You'll find a call from Colin's house to my cell phone that afternoon. That was from Jason right after he left the house.
Please answer the question. You don't know firsthand where he was for the rest of the night, do you?
No, not firsthand.
I had no idea what evidence the police had used to obtain their arrest warrant for Jason, but the sudden change in his supposed alibi, courtesy of his own wife, was not going to help matters. I knew that as I spoke, Olivia Randall was taking Colin to ADA King so Colin could provide a sworn statement regarding Jason's whereabouts, but we had no real way to prove where Jason was that night. Olivia had sent an investigator to Colin's building. They no longer had camera footage to establish that he and Jason had stayed in the apartment that night. On the other hand, there was no footage to prove that they had not. "Please don't punish Jason for this," I said. I just got nervous under pressure and blurted out that he was with me. But he was with Colin. The point is, he was nowhere near Long Island. I looked again to the grand jurors for signs of support, but found nothing but eyes avoiding my gaze. Not only did I not have an alibi for Jason, but the fact that I had initially lied for him made him look even guiltier. "That's enough," Rocco said. "I think your testimony speaks for itself." If they arrested him, they must have evidence. These people had heard the evidence, and they had concluded that Jason was a murderer, and I was the idiot trying to protect him. I thought she was about to excuse me from the room when she asked another question. "Does your ex-husband smoke, Miss Powell?" "No, he quit at New Year's."
"Does he use anything to help control the cravings?"
He chews Nicorette.
"Very good, thank you."
I could still feel my heart pounding in my chest as I stepped onto the elevator. I had planned to take the Long Island Railroad back to the city after testifying, but decided to board an eastbound train instead. I'd be in East Hampton within 90 minutes, give or take. 61. Mom walked in about half an hour after I arrived at her house. She flinched when she saw me sitting on the sofa.
"Jesus H, you scared me. Did you call?"
She was fumbling in her purse for her phone. "No, I had Grand Jury in Manila. Figured I was already halfway out."
"Well, there's a silver lining, I suppose.
Where's Spencer?"
"Spending the night with a friend." "Someone I'd approve of?"
"He has two nannies and a driver," I said. She rolled her eyes, and I gestured to the bottle of white wine I had already opened on her coffee table. She went to the kitchen for a glass and filled it halfway.
"You gonna tell me why you're really here?"
"What did you do, Mom?" She set the glass back down on the coffee table and stood up, ready for a fight. I shook my head, too tired to argue. "You didn't need to do that," I said.
"Of course I did. Someone had to protect you. You were obviously out of your mind."
"You already did protect me, Mom, but Jason doesn't deserve this."
"That's not how this works, baby girl. They don't just leave murders unsolved. And if someone was going to be blamed, of course it should be him."
"Where'd you get the gum?" The ADA's question about Jason's Nicorette habit had been the giveaway. There was only one reason she'd ask. I now knew at least one big piece of evidence in the case against my husband.
"Your rental."
I was searching my memory. Jason had been the one to drop off the Audi to the dealer after I took Spencer to camp. He drove the loaner back to the garage at the carriage house. He must have left gum in the ashtray. I never even noticed.
"He has one of the best defense attorneys in the city," she said. "And your husband spits that nasty gum out everywhere he goes. The lawyer can argue that anyone could have planted it there, including Tom Fisher. All she has to do is create reasonable doubt. Jason will be fine. He deserves to be put through the ringer for a while. Maybe he didn't tell that woman every bit of your business, but this is still on him."
"You really shouldn't have done that."
"Well, too late now. You told him about that magazine reporter?"
I nodded, realizing that my mother was right. I could no longer help Jason. "Yeah, he insisted that I take Spencer away until it's over." It was exactly the response I had anticipated. After all, when he said he would love us forever, he had meant it. 62. 1 month later. The timing for the move couldn't have been better. In August, there was hardly anyone around to notice that a young widow had moved to the island with her mother and 13-year-old son. I heard the wheels of the gate out front start to move, followed by the sound of the Jeep engine cutting in the driveway. It was just like my mother and son to drive the 5 blocks to the ocean. Spence still had patches of sand stuck to his bare skin when he burst through the door. "Outdoor shower, please." I met him out back and turned on the grill while he rinsed off. When I returned to the kitchen, my mother was inspecting the fish that I had left marinating in the refrigerator.
"I don't know why you have to be so fancy about things. Spencer and I would be just as happy with some hot dogs and potato chips."
"Well, I wouldn't. And it's Spence, Mom."
"Because that's really gonna fool anyone."
Susanna's story last summer about the underground market for government documents had come in handy. My name, according to my UK passport, was Susan Martin. Mom was known as Rosemary Parker. And Spencer now went by Spence, last name Martin, same as mine. My hair was now cropped short and bleached nearly white. Sometimes I barely recognized myself in the mirror. Spence says I look punk rock. Susanna understood my decision to leave, but thought my refusal to tell her where we were going was overkill. She eventually relented when I broke down in tears, telling her how paranoid I was that the New York Magazine writer was going to find out about my past. "Think about Spencer," I had pleaded. "I don't want the whole world to look at him and see Charles Franklin. I can't risk that. I'd rather be safe than sorry." That magazine writer didn't exist. Well, she did exist, but she had never called me. And to my knowledge, no other journalist was looking to write a profile about the former Mrs. Jason Powell. Not yet, anyway. I had promised Susanna that once we were set up somewhere new, I would let her know so she could visit. I still hadn't contacted her, and I doubted that I ever would. I had learned my lesson. She had been a good friend to me, but friendship had its limits. From now on, I would only trust my family. Me, Mom, Spence. Spence had been remarkably cooperative so far, because he was still convinced that Jason was guilty and that we were better off distancing ourselves. But eventually, I was going to face a decision on how much to tell my son about the real reason we had come here. Letting him have his way on his first name seemed only fair, given what I was putting him through. With a different last name, I didn't see the harm. "You may not like my food," I said, "but someone else does." "It went well?" she asked. I had asked the broker who found us our house to let me know if she heard about anyone who might need catering. As it turned out, she knew the owner of a modest little oceanfront restaurant with 12 foretops, whose chef had left for Anguilla to open his own place. The customer ratings on TripAdvisor were already starting to decline, even off-season. "You're looking at the new head chef at Margot's." My mother hugged me and told me how proud she was of me. When I went to bed that night, I reached for the notebook on the nightstand. Dr. Boyle was the one who suggested that I start keeping a journal when I told him that Spencer and I were leaving New York for a while. It was no substitute for regular sessions, he warned, but might prove therapeutic. I hadn't decided yet whether it was helping me, or even if I needed the help. But I tried to write once or twice a week anyway, burning the pages afterward when I used the grill, just to be safe. What if I hadn't gone to the bonfire that night? What if I hadn't accepted Charles Franklin's offer of a ride? What if I had run out the front door instead of checking his garage to see if it was safe to leave? And what if I had never gone to Carrie Lynch's house that night? When I feel my thoughts move in that direction, I shut them down. Because asking what if can lead to regrets, and regrets are dangerous. You make the best decisions you can make in the time you have to make them, and you move on. It's instinct. It's survival. I got in that car with Charles Franklin because it seemed safer than walking alone on a dark road at night. After a year of learning how to survive in that house, earning tiny privileges like time away from my room, use of a toilet, fresh squeezed juice when I was really good, he told me he was bored. He needed another girl. He had tried offering rides the way he had gotten me, but it wasn't working. He made my choice clear. Either I had to help him get another girl or he would kill me. What else was I supposed to do? We tried a few times, once at a mall in Cleveland, once in Philly. One time we drove all the way to Buffalo. As it turned out, not everyone was as trusting as I had been as I walked away from a bonfire party, even when there was a sweet girl in the passenger seat. Sometimes I thought about those girls, wondering how their lives turned out. They had no way of knowing that their entire futures had rested on a decision to turn down the offer of a ride from a nice-looking young couple in a white SUV. The girl from Cleveland had been the basis for Sarah when the police asked what I knew about her. I remembered passing signs on the highway for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, so I added that detail too. Charlie didn't like the idea of taking two girls from one location, but his desire to have someone new had bloomed into an obsession, and he was blaming our failures on me. I begged him to give me one more shot, but on my terms. We went back home to my home in East Hampton. I told him I knew a girl who would trust me. I didn't actually expect to find her. Not really. I crossed my fingers beneath my legs, hoping she was off on one of her excursions. It felt so surreal to be back again. The new chain drugstore, whose construction my parents complained about, was open on Main Street. We passed the bus stop where I'd been headed the night he took me. At the windmill, I looked longingly at the turn that led to my house. I felt my hopes drop as we reached the post office. We had gone all the way through East Hampton, the town where I was born and raised, and no one had recognized me. My plan had failed. I felt as if we were picking up speed with every block until his SUV was barreling east on 27. Pretty soon we'd reach Montauk, right around sunset. We had been cruising the area for 3 hours, not to mention the drive from Pittsburgh. He said if we reached the lighthouse without another girl, he'd drown me in Napeague Bay. I thought about honking the horn or grabbing the wheel and running us into a tree. And then I saw Tricia. She had her thumb out, walking backward along 27. My best guess was that she'd been drinking on Fort Pond. I had to make a split-second decision. I justified it by telling myself that together we would be stronger. With Trisha's help, I would find a way out. What shakes me to the core to this very day is how happy she was to see me. I told Charlie to pull over, and then I hopped out of the passenger seat. Trisha ran at me so hard she literally knocked me over. We were like two puppies wrestling in the sand at the side of the road. What are you doing here, girl? Where have you been? Get in, I said, pointing to the white SUV. Let's go party. Charlie put the cloth over her face, the same way he had when he had taken me a year earlier. It was the second worst thing I've ever done. You might think that killing Carrie is the worst thing I've done, but it's not. Even so, I forced myself to tamp down the what-ifs about that night, too. What if I had never read my husband's email? I wouldn't have seen those photographs just minutes before he came home to report the good news that Carrie's lawyer was open to settling. Or what if I had recognized Tom Fisher as he left Carrie's house? If I had realized who he was, I might have known that something was off with Carrie's story. I would have come to my senses and gone home. Instead, I watched him drive away and then I knocked on the door. I wanted to hear the truth about my husband, once and for all, straight from the source. She almost didn't let me in, but I told her that I had seen the pictures of her wrists. During the entire ordeal, the police visits, the arrest, the arraignment, the lawsuit, no one had ever told me the details of the alleged assault. It wasn't until I read that email from Olivia that I knew, or thought I knew, the truth. He did the same thing to me, I said. I believe you. When she let me inside, I asked her to tell me exactly what had happened. She was holding a glass of red wine. It was so bizarre standing there in her living room, two women on either side of her coffee table with nothing in common except what Jason had done to us. And then she laughed at me. You're even crazier than Jason said you were. I came here to be on your side, Carrie. I read the police reports. I thought I was being noble. You really don't get it, do you? He tied me up because I asked him to, and more than once, and I loved every second of it. We don't all have your hang-ups. I felt my mouth moving, but no words came out. Oh, my God, catch up, honey. She snapped her fingers for emphasis. I know your whole story. And I know it's why he'll never leave you. Jason loved me. No, he loves me. But he loved his persona more. And he can't be the good guy, Mr. Save the Planet, ex-mayor of New York, if he leaves his little Miss Perfect with a tragic backstory. You're a monster. Why would you tell me all this? For all she knew, I could have been recording her. I could testify to every word. You admitted that you're lying. I'm calling the DA. She grabbed my arm. No, you're not. You do that, and I'll tell everyone what I know. You're that girl from the house in Pittsburgh. Who's the monster, Angela? Me? Or the woman who makes a man stay with her out of sympathy? You wouldn't even let him adopt Spencer, so he has no choice. He's stuck with you. If he leaves, he loses his kid. I know all about you. The glass egg was heavy. At least 15 pounds. I heard her skull crack the first time I hit her. She fell to the floor and was struggling to push herself upright. I hit her one more time, and then another, until she stopped moving. What if I had waited for her to finish her sentence? Maybe if I had heard her out, I would have realized that Jason only told Carrie about me, not that Spencer wasn't mine. But the sound of my son's name in her mouth made me certain she knew the whole story. Or what if I had told my mother less about what really happened that night? I could have simply called her from that gas station payphone, told her I was in trouble, and given her the address. She had proven over and over again, first when I went missing and then when I was found, and ever since, that she would run through fire to protect me. And that is probably why I had trusted her, as always, with the entire truth. She was at the house in a little more than an hour. Just like my instincts had kicked in on the day when Detective Duncan was on our stoop, I saw every piece of a plan. Cleaning the floor, wiping down everything I touched, getting rid of the glass egg. The only thing I panicked about was the dog. I used a dish towel as a makeshift glove to fill his bowls, assuming that Carrie's absence would be noticed when she didn't show up to work the next day. I decided that if 2 days passed, I would make an anonymous call from a city payphone to check on her. And the funny thing is, I don't think I even saw her as a real person until I looked at that dog and wondered how he was going to feel when he realized his best friend wasn't coming back. Mom would drive Carrie's body all the way to the East End. If anyone ever suspected me, I'd have an alibi of sorts. Spencer's phone call, plus the movie streamed as soon as I got home 3.5 hours later. When that detective showed up at my door asking about Jason, I said he was home with me, so both of us were accounted for. It was a good plan, but apparently not good enough for Mom, who added her own touch by retrieving Jason's gun from the car and dropping it in the sand only 3 feet from Carrie's body on Ocean Beach. It was already clear that Olivia Randall was planning to argue that Tom Fisher had framed Jason for the murder. It wouldn't be hard to find witnesses to testify that Jason was constantly chewing that stupid gum, leaving it like breadcrumbs to mark his whereabouts. Carrie's own lawyer would testify that her client had been demanding huge amounts of money both from Jason and Fisher. Combined with the documents FSS had managed to get from Oasis about their Africa dealings, it would be easy to prove that Fisher had at least as much to lose as Jason. Colin was sticking to his alibi testimony, and he'd be a good witness. Literally, all the state had was its motive and a piece of gum. Olivia Randall would soak the courtroom with reasonable doubt. As my son had said when he first heard Rachel Sutton's name, Jason wouldn't end up in prison. We were rich. Do you hate me yet? Maybe not. Technically, I was an accomplice to Trisha's kidnapping, which makes me, as a legal matter, just as guilty as Charlie Franklin. But I was also his victim. He threatened to kill me if I didn't find him another girl. I had gotten boring. There was another reason I chose her. From what she had told me, I figured her home life wasn't much better than what we could manage at Charlie's house together. Even so, the first month was awful. He left me alone while she suffered the brunt of his attention. After that, it sort of evened out. When Charlie was at work, Trisha and I had each other. It was actually tolerable. But then it became clear Trisha was going to have a baby. Charlie punched her in the stomach 3 days in a row, trying to make it go away. Trisha and I made a vow to him and to each other that we would take care of the child growing inside of her. We would do anything and everything that Charlie wanted so that he would let us keep him. It made Charlie feel like we loved him, all for a little boy or girl we didn't know yet. And the strangest thing happened. Spencer was born, and this horrible man, who took so much pleasure in hurting us, loved his baby. He would rush home to hold his son. He was nice to us, if that's imaginable. Trisha and I took turns going to his room every couple of days. He started letting us go outside, as long as we went one at a time, so each one of us had to worry about the other as we walked around in freedom. We told the neighbors we were his nieces. Considering what I'd been through the last 3 years, it wasn't that bad. Then a police officer knocked on the front door, and all four of us were in the SUV while an Amber Alert blasted out on repeat across the airwaves. It was that Amber Alert that led to the very worst thing I've ever done. I repeated the official story to law enforcement so many times that the horrific facts became rote. Charlie killed Sarah because he didn't want us to fit the description of two teenage girls and a baby. He pulled over at a boat slip 2 hours north of Pittsburgh. He ordered me to stay with the baby and Sarah to get out. He had a gun. I heard 2 shots. He came back to the car alone and told me to look older. It was so close to the truth. I remember the sting of the splinter that worked its way beneath my skin when I dropped to my knees on the dock. When I wake up in the middle of the night, I still feel the cold metal of the gun barrel against the base of my neck and the warmth of my own urine on my thighs. The story unfolded just the way I told it, but I was the one Charlie had rejected. I was the one he had ordered from the car and marched to the end of that pier. And once again, I chose to survive. The words seemed to come from nowhere as I stared out over the dark water. "I look older," I blurted. I could pass for your wife.
It was true. I had always been the one who could buy us beer or talk us into a club. Trisha was a year older, but I looked at least 3 years older than her. And I doted on the baby at least as much as she did. And I had been the one who helped him get Trisha to come home with us. I was the one who didn't run away. I was smarter and more cunning and better behaved. I was the one he could trust. I try not to think about the momentary expression of relief that crossed her face when I returned to the car with Charlie. When I heard the two gunshots, I was holding Spencer in my lap, telling him that we were going to be okay. So, do I have any regrets? No. The choices I made brought us here, to this beautiful island, where I have my family, a new job, and enough money to keep us safe. Sometimes I do look out over the Atlantic Ocean and think about Trisha.
63. The woman who answered the front door at Virginia Mullins' house was probably around 50 years old. Her perfectly highlighted pixie cut was at odds with her outfit, an oversized Jets t-shirt, long denim shorts, and Crocs.
I'm looking for the home's owner? Corinne asked, holding up her badge to allow a closer inspection.
She's not here right now.
When do you expect her back? Her phone numbers have been disconnected. The woman's brow furrowed.
Like most people, she was uncomfortable with an unannounced police visit. I'm not real sure. Her daughter was going through a rough time, so they left town for a little while.
Through the open door, Corinne saw that the television was on, but muted. Baby toys were scattered on the floor, and one of those portable playpens was popped open in the corner of the living room. A half-eaten sandwich waited on a plate on the coffee table.
You're living here?
Corinne asked. The woman wiped her hand against her shorts and offered it to Corinne for a shake.
Sorry, my name's Lucy. Lucy Carter. Jenny and I have worked together for years. Please come in. Careful of the mess. Grammy's the babysitter when Mommy's at the hair salon. My grandson's only 9 months, but he can take over a house within minutes.
The hairstyle made more sense now. So, are you living here? Corinne asked again. She tried to sound officious, as if the two women had broken some kind of city code or tax rule by not reporting a change in residency.
Just staying here, really. She gave me keys and told me to treat the house as my own until she came back. She said it was better than leaving it empty.
What about property taxes, insurance, that kind of thing? Lucy shrugged.
Hasn't come up yet. I assume she'll be back by then. Are you here about her son-in-law? Angela divorced him, you know. She's got nothing to do with him anymore. That's why they left town. Angela wanted to get her kid out of the city until the trial is over.
Oh, I know. It was the same story Angela had given her super when she suddenly moved out last month. Corinne had now been searching for Angela for a week. No forwarding address, bank accounts closed, no airline, train, or bus tickets purchased. She was a ghost. And now her mother was gone, too, precisely as she had expected. Corinne had a cover story ready. It turns out Angela's entitled to some money from when she initially posted bail for him, seeing as how he's being held now. Do you mind if I take a look around to see if Ginny left behind any hints about where they might have gone?
That'd be fine.
Corinne was rifling through a drawer in the kitchen that most people would call a junk drawer. Two notepads, but no relevant notes, owner's manuals, pens, a screwdriver and a hammer, a spare Honda key. Did Ginny leave you her car, too? The Powells had sold their Audi, but according to the DMV, Angela's mother still had a current-year model Honda Pilot registered in her name. Corinne hadn't seen it in the driveway. Lucy was finishing her sandwich on the sofa.
I assume she took it.
Or, Corinne thought, she paid someone to scrap it so it couldn't be searched for Carrie Lynch's blood. It all came back to that one nagging question. How had Jason Powell gotten to Long Island and back the night of Carrie's murder? Every time Corinne pictured it, she saw him in a car. She made a list of all the possibilities and started checking them in her spare time, when the taxis, rental car companies, car services, and every other way of scoring a ride from the city were exhausted, she circled back to the Audi. She called the Manhattan dealer and asked the service department to pull up the Powell's account, hoping a mechanic might have noticed a device used to protect the license plate from the view of automatic cameras. The garage manager told her that Marty was the last person to work on the car.
Doubt he remembers much from a job that came in on June 6th.
Not exactly an Einstein. Corinne sat up straighter at the mention of the date. It was the last day Carrie was seen. Do you happen to know if you gave them a loaner? She heard tapping on a keyboard.
Yep, The new S6, yeah, for 3 days, 116 miles.
It hadn't taken Corinne long to find the loner in the plate reader data from the night of the murder. Outbound on the Williamsburg Bridge at 7:41 p.m., then inbound at 10:53. The time and the mileage would cover the round trip between the Powell's house and Carrie's, but it didn't get Jason all the way out to where Carrie's body was found. She called the Nassau County prosecutor with the evidence, but ADA Rocco was unpersuaded. She planned to argue that Jason hid Carrie's body somewhere near her house before going back out to Long Island and moving her again. Corinne was convinced Rocco was refusing to see the truth because she had screwed up by subpoenaing Angela to the grand jury, automatically giving her immunity. Corinne remembered what the East Hampton detective said about Angela. When push comes to shove, she trusts her mother more than anyone. Angela would have left the house shortly after the phone call from her son and started streaming the movie as soon as she got back, while her mother was driving Carrie's corpse to Ocean Beach. It was the only explanation. Angela might have immunity, but Jenny didn't, which meant Corinne might have an angle if she could only find them. She had searched every drawer in every room of the small house. The only hint she had gleaned came from the family photographs on the walls, nearly all of them on the beach, but the world had a lot of beaches. Her final desperate step was to flip through each book on the built-in shelf of what had once been Angela's bedroom. A hollowed-out book was still one of the best do-it-yourself hiding places. A photograph slipped from a dusty, dog-eared copy of Flowers in the Attic. Two teenage girls stood on the beach, their arms around each other's waists. Angela's sandy blonde hair was pulled into a ponytail at the top of her head. She was wearing a high-leg one-piece that would have been trendy in the late 1990s. Her friend had short, blunt-cut, dark brown hair and was wearing a bikini top and baggy, low-slung, cut-off jean shorts, exposing a tattoo of a rose vine on her right hip. Corinne was about to tuck the photo back in place when she did a double take. The location of the tattoo matched. So did the size. And something about the girl's face seemed vaguely familiar. She looked like someone. Corinne clicked through every possibility. Angela, Jason, Carrie, Rachel, Colin, Spencer. Spencer. She remembered thinking he looked more like Charles Franklin than his mother. She finished her search, found Lucy in the living room, and held up the picture. Do you know who this girl is with Angela? Lucy made a tisk sound. Trisha Faulkner. Those two were inseparable back in the day. She did not make it sound like a good thing. Do you know where she is now? Nope, she used to come and go as she pleased, even as a teenager. She up and left for good right after high school. Can't say I blame her, that the whole family's full of criminals. Corinne's gaze drifted back to the photograph, wondering if it was possible. She ran the dates in her head. So, she's been gone for about 14 years? Well, she was a year ahead of Angela, so yeah, I guess that's right. Time sure does fly. The timing couldn't be a coincidence. And the longer Corinne studied Trisha's features, the greater the resemblance she saw to Spencer Powell. Corinne's mind was pinging with possibilities, but she was certain of one thing. This girl deserved to be claimed. She could call the Pittsburgh police and suggest they compare the DNA of Franklin's unidentified victim to one of Trisha's family members. Depending on what she learned about the Faulkners, maybe she would keep her suspicions about Spencer's biological lineage to herself. At least for the time being. When she got to her car, she called ADA King. I want you to get me a meeting with Olivia Randall. He knew she was annoyed that the Nassau County DA had blown her off about the mileage on the loaner car, but he had talked her out of going to Powell's defense attorney directly. You're not letting this go, are you? No way. Fine, I'll make the call. Corinne had asked Angela how well she knew her husband. Now she was going to find out how much Jason knew about his wife. This is Exie Sands. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Wife, a novel, by Alifair Burke. This program was produced by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director, executive producer Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2018 by Alifair Burke. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.